Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for January 11th, 2024, moving into this next year of insanity. But anyway, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to try and keep on a somewhat positive note tonight, although there's some interesting things on the negative side of the balance, as always. Anyway, last week I talked about college football. And I talked specifically about two bowl games that decided the outcome and who was going to play for the national championship. And my, you know, I've been watching football all my life, you know, like most of you out there. And I started coming to the realization, not from these games, but from other games and in past years. And I said, you know, this game looked like it was fixed, you know, because the outcome just should not have been. And there were just too many things here that pointed to a game being fixed. And not to mention all of the money that was on the line, all the money that was being bet on these games. College football has become a big betting game. And then it's not just who wins or loses, but it's the point spread. Because, you know, sometimes there's a clear favorite and they're going to win probably. So they have a spread and you can bet on the spread. And so there's all different kinds of ways to bet, even up into the game from what I understand. So I don't know. I'm not a bettor. I'm not a gambler. So I don't know all of the ins and outs of how they put money in a game. But there's a lot of money, a boatload, as they say, a big tanker boatload of money that's bet on these games. And so the outcome, I mean, we're talking, you know, and then you talk about the people who are running the odds games, et cetera, and their money put into it, and they're putting, you know, millions. So they have a lot of money on the line on these games. And how would you fix a game? How would you fix a game? The first obvious one is you would go to the refs. But that could be pretty obvious. But, you know, a ref could control a game just with a single call, a single bad call that allows a penalty or disallows a penalty or just doesn't happen to notice a penalty. And in this game Monday night, the national championship game, there was a lot of really questionable referee calling. Let me just put it that way. And it seemed to be towards one side. As an example, late in the game, there was a helmet hit. It's called targeting, where you take your helmet and drive it into the opposing player. And a lot of times after the play is dead, even. So that happened against this number two player. No, I think it was number two. And he had quite a few penalties throughout the game, severe, you know, roughing after the play type of penalties, etc. But this targeting penalty, they called it, and then they came back and they said, oh, well, after review, no targeting, and the guy gets to stay in the game. That guy is critical to the Michigan defense, that particular guy. And if they put a substitute in there, chances are that would have changed the outcome of the game. And so it's very strange to see and even the announcers were going, whoa, what's this? You know, kind of like, whoa, what the heck? They call this, it's very clear. And then there were holding penalties, etc., that were not called. I mean, you know, anyway, on and on. But the obvious choice, if you were going to fix a game, would be with the referees. The second choice would be a couple of high-level players on a given team. The quarterback, a specific, say, wide receiver that or tight end or something like that, who are game changers. These are the game changer people. And what's in it for them? Well, they are looking at careers in professional football. So their goal is to make money. And anyway, picking out a particular player or players, just a couple of them, take him aside somewhere where nobody's looking, nobody's watching. You know, walking down the hall one day, a guy walks up and, "Hey, how's it going?" A couple words are said, a couple messages are received somehow. And I don't know, I wouldn't know how this would be done, in terms of the communication with players or how this would happen. But if you look at, say, the quarterback for Washington, he was making these bomb passes with threading the needle literally in the week before, and he couldn't hit one of them this week. Overthrowing many, many passes. Now, if you are like an underdog, Washington State would have been the underdog in this game, being number two in the nation, with Michigan being number one. The way to stay in this game is to stay within a touchdown, and that means even 10 points. I mean, let's look at the game itself. Michigan scored two back-to-back early touchdowns in the game to give them 14-0 lead. Then they had two field goals, and then nothing till late into the third quarter, where they finally drove one in at short range again. But until that point, Washington was very much in the game, within 7 points or 10 points, which is nothing. That can turn it around in a flash. A touchdown, another reception, an interception, something like that. And all of a sudden, you have a 14-point spread erased in a New York second. All of the overthrown passes. Now, there was a lot of pressure put on that quarterback, I have to admit that. I'm not going to go into recapping the whole game, but my inkling, I will just put it that way, is that these big bowl games are fixed. It's an inkling. And I'm not saying it is or it isn't, or accusing one player or another, anything like that, because clearly these guys are going out and playing their tails off. If you look at the Washington State defense, they were in the game most of the game, so by the end they were like crawling. You have to keep your offense out on the field, because that's where you can relax. If you're making first downs, one, two, three downs, and then first down, one, two, three downs, and then first down, you're wearing down that other defense. That's part of the game. That's part of the strategy. And so that's understandable. But the Washington defense did an excellent job besides those first two touchdowns early in the game. They did an excellent job of containing Michigan State throughout the entire game into late in the third quarter, early fourth quarter. Washington was still very much in the game. And so anyway, all I'm saying is, if you look at the factors, the number of money that's put on these games, and the amount of interest, and then also just what is in it for these players? National championship, you would think, well, that's got to be the golden egg. That's got to be the prize. That's got to be what they're all going for. But in another sense, not really, because they're all up in the point where they're all going to be pros. Most of these guys that have their eyes on being a pros, whether they're a lineman, defense, whether they're a receiver or a runner, most of these guys will end up in the pros somewhere, and on both of these teams. They may not be in the first round draft picks, but they'll be picked up by some major team, because those teams have an outflux too. They have alignment, they have these big guys. They don't last long in the pros, and their legs get just hammered on, and they're I knew a guy once who was a lineman. He had two Super Bowl rings. I saw him. This guy was a big guy, and I don't remember what team he played for. But he was a lineman, and what he was doing was selling insurance and caretaking an apartment building. But his legs were all battered up, and being bad, he could hardly walk. So, you know, and he two Super Bowl rings. He was in the mix. He was a starter for one of these teams, and I don't know if he played defense or offense or whatever. But, yeah, and he was still a big guy, you know, with a lot of extra weight at that point. But they don't last forever. So they have to have a new influx of young, healthy young people to take over these positions. So there's a big turnover. So most of these college kids that get up to these bowl game levels are going to be in the pros. That's just, you know, making decent money. That's the golden egg, not winning a national championship. Winning a national championship is great, but the real golden egg is that long-term contract with a pro team. And so then on top of that, some of these guys get hurt and they don't last forever. You know, so they might have an ankle injury and they're out. They're out. I mean, there's no insurance policy for a guy that goes in the pros and is a great player, but he has some kind of injury. And it happens a lot. It happens a lot in these when you get to that level. And that's an injury that bounces them out and makes another contender come in there and play. You know, so part of being a pro is being a pro, being there, being available. And part of it is staying healthy, staying out of injuries. Okay, so at any rate, I don't know. And I'm not going to cast sins or whatever, judgmental. I'm just saying that it seems funny that these players can complete these passes, boom, 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 1 week, winning a game, a tough game, equally tough game. Any of these teams on a given day could beat one of the other teams. I'm convinced of that. Once you get up to the top four or six or eight teams, on a given day, any one of those teams could beat another one of these teams. The top two teams here were 14-0 records. Washington and Michigan. But still, on a given day, they could lose to some other team that just was up for the challenge. Also, the play calling. You know, when you look at plays that are just out of place, and their ability to call other plays that would be much more appropriate. Anyway, I don't know. I really don't know. But when other people are not talking about a subject, I'll bring it up on this show. And it might be completely out of the realm of science, whereas gambling, you might consider that is within the scope of science and mathematics, because it is statistics. It's all about mathematical odds, etc. And winning a game, and how do you win? You know, like if you go to Vegas, if you're a gambler, you know, it's interesting because the local people in Vegas know that Friday night, that's when they go to the casinos, because they know that the machines are turned up to allow winning, because that's when the tourists come in, is Friday night. And they, you know, the guys drinking free drinks at the slot machine or the table or whatever they're playing. And they loosen everything up so those people win. So they know they're going to be handing out money on Friday night. But the local people know that, so they go down and gamble on Friday night. But they don't go back Saturday and Sunday like the tourists. And by Saturday, the tourists are kind of groggy. They're half in the bag, drunk. You know, by Sunday, all that money's back and more. And I don't know how many people that gamble I've heard say, I always win. Every time I go to Vegas, I'm a winner. Well, they don't remember Saturday and Sunday when they lost it all and more. They just remember that Friday night when they were winning like crazy, you know, and the odds were scaled. So the old saying, Vegas never loses. Anyway, back to college football. I don't know. I don't know. You may have an opinion And I don't have a blog page where people could write in their opinions. You can just kind of hash this one amongst your game watching buddies. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Enough of that. I'm not going to bring that up again, at least until next year, when it happens again. Here's an interesting archaeology story. Just came in. A listener sent this in, actually. North Dakota, a place you would normally not associate with large woolly animals, mammoths, and in fact, literally mammoths. In a coal mine, coal miners were digging through the coal mine, mining the coal, and found a mammoth tusk. Now, let's just look at this for a minute. First of all, North Dakota is not a place where you would have fauna that would support a mammoth, let alone a whole herd of them, because one mammoth didn't just live there by itself. There are herds of these, thousands, tens of thousands of them in a herd. And, eating. So, I mean, look at the amount of grub that they have to eat in a day. So you would need that amount of fauna and then, reproduce on a given day also. So you have this tremendous amount of food necessary for these mammoths to live. Okay, now we get to the point, and it's just not there in North Dakota is the point. So how did woolly mammoths live in North Dakota? Well, things must have been different. And I'm going to get to the point of where does coal come from? And that's one of the biggest myths on the planet when we talk about the source of oil and coal and natural gas. Those are the big ones. Those are the big ones that we use for energy. Coal mining, and that's of course being shut down because of ecological green sediment, s s sentiment, not sediment, sentiment with an N. Sentiment to stop the pollution of the air and the burning of fuels, etc. But the coal mine, now, where do coal mines really come from? The real answer is that coal mines were formed when big tsunamis raced across the land. Where did the big tsunamis come from? They came from passing comets, large comets. And so the tsunami just took up that water, came in like a giant bulldozer, picked up all of the vegetation, slammed it up against the side of a mountain somewhere, or in a ravine or whatever, or in North Dakota, just deposited it. When the water recedes, that plant matter then, because of the pressure, the water goes out. And you're left with carbon, basically coal. That's where coal comes from. Coal that has high hydrocarbon content, in other words, oil. There's two types of coal. There's dry coal, and then there's high energy coal, which has a lot of oil in it, which burns much hotter. And so the oil happens to come because the passing comet also provides oil. The Earth passing through that comet tail provides the hydrocarbons that then are impregnated in the oil. So that's where coal really comes from. It's not this fern forest from millions of years ago. And if it were from millions of years ago, how did a woolly mammoth tusk get buried in this coal? Because the woolly mammoths lived much later than the dinosaurs. So, coal was said to be from the fern forest in the dinosaur era. So that couldn't be true. As they say in mathematics, one counterexample negates a proof. So if you can find a counterexample in a mathematical proof, then, like I say, it negates the proof. And that type of proof by contradiction, it is called proof by contradiction, is a standard method of proving things in mathematics or in mathematical logic. So, coal is not from the dinosaur era, at least not all of it. There is some coal from the dinosaur era. In fact, there's coal from almost every era There is coal right now within the last 10 years that is being formed because of a tsunami. We require the tsunami that hit India. It came from Sumatra. I believe it's called the Sunda Strait. It's where Krakatoa is. Anyway, there was a large earthquake there with a landslide underwater that created a tsunami. Remember, it swept into eastern India, killing people. In some places, that tsunami went as much as 100 miles inland, killing untold numbers of people and causing untold amount of damage. That same tsunami continued on to Madagascar. Now, Madagascar is a little bit different scenario in that there are mountain ranges. And so what happened is in tropical, dense tropical foliage on that eastern side of Madagascar. So the wave comes in, it picks up all of that material. Like I say, it's just like a big bulldozer comes in and sweeps it all up and piles it against the side of a mountain and leaves it there. So that is a modern example of coal being built. But of course, modern geology doesn't recognize this because they got to keep up this facade of coal coming from millions of years ago from dinosaur bones. Whoever dreamt up that, well, you got to remember those theories came from back around the late 1800s. That's where the dinosaur bone fossil fuel narrative came from, and that's where they say oil came from. A lot of the oil that's in shale, that's in for example, in Venezuela, they have various types of oil that's mixed into the ground material. Canada has the sand oil where they process the sand and get the oil out of the sand. So the oil is in various types of situations. Well, when they first discovered oil in the Middle East, it was around 1200 AD, and they found it as pools on the surface, and they started using it and learned that it was very good for fires. You could burn it, this oil, so process they then started processing the oil, making it into different types of varieties of products. It became useful in warfare. They would soak like hemp rope with oil and then make it into a big bundle and then throw it with catapults and throw it into like a city over a wall. And that would, when it hit, it would break apart and send this burning stuff all over the place. So, a very effective, very lethal weapon. And of course, like anything that burns or explodes, it's easily turned into some kind of a weapon almost immediately. But oil was first discovered in the Middle East as pools. And then when they used that up, then they realized, well, if you just dig down a little bit, there's some in the sand underneath that. And if you keep going down, you find more and more. And then there's actually really big deposits below that. And then to the point we are today, where our entire energy economy is based on oil that is extracted from deep pools down in the ground. And of course, fracking is one of the new techniques for bringing up natural gas and oil. But unfortunately, what happens is once you extract that, then the next pass at getting more of it out is much more difficult because you're but also when they're removing oil from the ground, they have to pressurize underground and to force the oil out so that it comes out the pumps that pump it to the surface. Remember the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico? It really wasn't an oil spill. What happened is as you get down to lower and lower depths, farther and farther down into the ground, the pressure becomes enormous because all of this land, earth matter is on top of it. So the pressures are very high. So if you poke a hole in the earth down to the level where that oil is, which is a fluid, then that comes up with all of that pressure. So there are now laws, I don't know how effective they are, that limit how deep you can drill, because you're really poking a hole in the surface of the earth, and that's like a balloon. A balloon has pressure inside. You poke a hole in the balloon, and wham, that pressure wants to get out of there. That's an escape route. So oil is the same when you're going down deep. So that BP oil spill really was not an oil spill. It was a cap that just couldn't withhold the pressure that's coming up from that drilling. And there were ways to cap that at the time, but they didn't do it. It was kind of like Fukushima. There were ways to clean that up right from the very beginning, but they didn't do it. Okay, so anyway, back to the idea of mammoth tusks in coal in North Dakota. So, in summary, coal is not necessarily from the dinosaur era, it's from much more recent time. And so, the other part of the theory of coal, the standard theory, is that it takes a long time. And what they say is it grew in the fern forest, and the fern forest decayed and then piled up this matter, kind of like dirt, and that turned into oil. But nobody has ever been able to duplicate this process where you take dirt and turn it into oil. Simply doesn't work. It would be a process you would be able to duplicate in the laboratory. And if you could, you could take dirt and turn it into oil. That'd be fantastic. Nice, cheap way to get oil. But there is no such way to do that. And so oil literally comes from the tails of comets. And the ancients talk about this. The ancients are very clear. The burning, raining in from the sky, burning naphtha. They called it naphtha. And when the oil hit the upper atmosphere, there was plenty of oxygen. And then the meteorites coming in from the comet tail also would ignite the hydrocarbons. And when it came down, it was like big splotches of burning oil and would hit the ground and explode and cause burns on the people. They talk about this. The ancients talk about this. It's the rain of brimstone and fire from above. There were cities in completely demolished by this. Sodom and Gomorrah being a good example. Okay, so at any rate, enough of that. But the idea that North Dakota would support these herds of mastodons, mammoths, woolly mammoths, is absurd because North Dakota will support buffaloes, herds of buffaloes, which are much smaller, a much smaller animal with nutrient demands that are far less than the mammoths. Okay. Now here's a story that I think is very important, and this is not new news. It's just that there are newer studies coming out. Plastic bottles. Now, as you know, I sell water filters, and one of the things I try and preach to people is that if you have your own water filtration in your home, then you can fill your own water bottle and carry that with you. You don't have to buy these little thin plastic bottles out there and thinking you're getting healthy water. Hundreds of thousands of microparticles of plastic in the water that's in those bottles. So it's not only the chemicals that leach into the water, causing cancer, but it's these hundreds of thousands in a given bottle, hundreds of thousands of little micro plastic particles floating in that water. So yeah, drink it down, buddy. Get your workout as you're working out and you're feeling fit, and then you pour down a bottle of hundreds of thousands of little plastic pieces that are clogging up your system, confusing it. Going into your cells, blocking the passageways, going into your lungs, into your organs, your liver, your heart. You gotta stop using plastic bottles. And the worst ones are those really thin ones that you buy at the convenience store with the water in it, with a nice shiny label that tells you how beautiful that water is, but it really isn't. So the water is not filtered, for one, so you get typically, it's just tap water in a bottle. So you're getting all the chemicals that come in water from the city, from the wells, from the underground water sources, the glyphosates, everything else, pharmaceuticals. So you're getting all that. You're getting the chemicals that are leaching into the water from the plastic bottle and hundreds of thousands of tiny little microplastic pieces. So go ahead, drink up. But what I suggest that people do is get yourself a water filter, even if it's like a gravity on-the-counter water filter. Fill up your own water bottles. And if you have a family, my recommendation is to get a whole house water filter. And right now they're still on sale. The sale won't last forever. But the whole house water filter, the MR5, what we call the best deal, is the MR5 whole house water filter. It comes with the ultraviolet sterilizer, which kills any bacteria or viruses that get through the MR5, and then an extra pack of filter elements for the MR5. And the UV sterilizer comes with two bulbs. The two bulbs, you change the bulbs out once every 12 months, so that gives you 2 years of the UV sterilizer use. And the two packs of filter elements that come with it, one in the MR5 itself, and then the extra set, will last you, a family of four, probably a year each, so that's another 2 years. So you get about 2 years worth of use out of this. And here are the economics. We figured this out. I was on an interview the other day talking about this. Imagine a family of four people, and each person buys a water bottle a day at the convenience store. It's about $1.50 a piece, so that's $6. Multiply that times 365 days in a year, and you come up into the low $2,000 range. That's what you're paying just for that terrible water in that bottle. And you could replace that by having your whole house water filter, so the water is in both the hot and cold water is filtered. And then you fill your own water bottle. And you can fill it from the bathroom sink, the kitchen sink, the sink downstairs in the laundry room. Here's the deal. If you only have a gravity filter and that's all you can afford, we sell the 10 packs of replacement filter elements for the gravity system. Yes, and it fits all makes and models. They're all the same. That is $189 for a four pack. That includes shipping. $399, I'm sorry, for a 10 pack. That includes shipping. But the MR5 Best Deal Package is $1,580 if you buy a couple 10 packs of the gravity filter elements. You're almost up to 50% of a whole house water filter. But here's the deal. When you are in the shower, the daily shower, that's when you get the royal dose of toxins. It goes through your skin. Your skin is the biggest absorbing organ of your body. And it's taking all of that water, including the toxins, and going right into your system, into your bloodstream, and then you're breathing the vapors. That's going right into your bloodstream, including the toxin, goes right into your cells, direct drive. There's no liver or kidney that's going to filter that out. So the place where you get the royal dose of toxins is in the daily shower. So just in summary, the regular price on the MR5 Best Deal Package is $23.80. It's now on sale for $15.80, so $800 off. Good grief. So that covers your installation, and we'll help your plumbers install. We'll help your plumber, and if they have any questions during the installation. But it should take a normal plumber 3 to 5 hours, somewhere in that time range, to install it. It's not a big deal. Okay, so anyway, okay, I'm not going to dwell on that, but good grief. I'm just really, really over the top trying to get people to get a whole house water filter for your health and safety. These plastic bottles, and then get yourself a real good either stainless steel or aluminum water bottle. Fill it at home. You'll pay for your whole house water filter in less than a year. Average family of four. Good grief. Okay, enough of that. Just go to the webpage. The water filter webpage is jmcc waterfilters.com. And remember, now there's a link to the coffee page. I'm promoting a group that's starting to import real premium specialty coffee. So all the information on the webpage, I'm not going to talk on this show about that. Just go to the webpage. All that information is there. But go to the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage, and there's a link there also for the coffee page. Okay. Today I'm going to do an update on outer space and a little bit on hydrogen fuel, because I get these updates on a daily basis. They're like briefings, basically news briefs, dealing with all the different things going on in outer space. And there is a lot of companies out there, a lot of little companies that are doing very innovative space work. Something that the government was supposed to do, but, and NASA is still involved in a lot of space-related things, but the private industries are just taken over by leaps and bounds. So I just want to go through a little bit of an update on what's going on, where are we going in 2024, what to expect. And, of course, at the top of the list is SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, that is just doing amazing work. They have their launch program. 2023 was a bumper year for launches, and 2024 will be even bigger. Their success rate is amazing. So they have the launch systems down, except for the big rockets, the experimental rockets. They're still ironing out some of the bugs, and so, but that's expected. They're dealing with some of the biggest rockets ever built. So anyway, interesting, they're using the mini rocket engine approach, which makes a lot of sense. If you have, like, say, with the Saturn V rocket back in the old Apollo days, amazing rockets, but you had five engines, and they had to work precisely, whereas if you have many engines, they can vary. There's a lot more flexibility in the performance on those engines. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to start kind of a laundry list of what you might expect here in the future. And a lot of it has to do with foreign countries, with Japan, China, India, stepping up their programs in outer space. China, for example, just launched surveying satellites, which gives them the ability to survey land regions from above. So remember this hype about the balloon, the Chinese balloon that came across the United States, and there was all of this speculation, or they could, see great detail, etc. No, you can, believe me, from these satellites that they're launching and that other countries are launching, you can see an ant walking around. With the ability to focus and get data, it's amazing. And stereo data, where you get the three-dimensional landscape, etc. So China, big on, it's called remote viewing, remote sensing, satellites to basically gain data about the Earth. China's launching in the LSAR-01 satellite group, which is a disaster response series of satellites. In other words, China is so big and it has so many people that they need instant data. If there's a typhoon that comes in, or, that can affect shipping, coastal populations, if they have other disasters, earthquake, etc. And so having these satellites, which basically are designed simply for recovery after natural disasters, helps them mitigate, first of all, be able to predict situations ahead of time. And that actually happened in Japan, where they were predicting certain natural events, and it helped mitigate the earthquake damage, which I'll be talking about just in a minute here. Also, China launching from their Gobi test center, the Jingquan launch center on the northwestern part of the Gobi Desert, where they have a launch facility. They launched four satellites and in a single launch. So this is getting to the multiple launch capability with their rocket systems. And remember that China really didn't do anything in outer space for a long time. It was mainly Russia, the United States, Japan kind of tinkered in it, the European Space Agency tinkered in it, but the real big players were Russia and the United States. And then after the Reagan Cold War era, after the end of the Soviet Union and the beginning of the current governmental situation in Russia, there was a lot of economic stress, especially in the sciences. That's when, for example, I happened to work with these Russian scientists, and they were in the aftermath of that. So the and they were living in barracks. They were teaching at the university in Novosibirsk. They were atmospheric scientists, very good scientists, but they had literally no resources, and they were getting just a pittance for pay. They would make about $75 a month per month. That's what these guys were making. And full university professors, very good scientists, but very poorly funded. And so that's why a lot of them had to basically succumb to the NASA programs, where they would have access to good equipment, well-funded programs, etc. But of course, in doing so, they had to give up their freedom of thought and speech. Where I was working with them, they understood that my work was correct, that the Dirty Snowball Comet model had no place in science at all, and all of the other work that I was doing, discovering the cause of, for example, tornadoes on the sun. The solar surface had these tornadoes that would race across the surface, and they couldn't figure out what was causing them. And of course, my work explained the same situation as with our own atmospheric tornadoes and cyclonic storms, that they were due to the discharge of the vertical electric field, and that explains the cyclonic motion, the lifting, the vacuum at the center, etc. Okay, so anyway, the Chinese, all of this time, were sitting in the background, really not doing much. They were just trying to manage 2 billion people. So, and there's this incredible population growth that they were experiencing. So, when China finally pulled the trigger and said, "We're going to go out and get in the space program," it was at about that same time, and they went off to Russia, and they bought technology off the shelf, rocket technology, launch technology, fueling technology, docking in outer space technology. One of the most difficult things to do, and the one thing that took the United States a long time to develop in there, that's what the whole Gemini program was about, was learning how to dock in outer space and get one guy from one space capsule into the other space capsule and back again. And so Russia was the same. It took them a while to gain capabilities in outer space. Just the hardware, the day-to-day things like oxygen tanks and maintaining human life support systems, the temperature inside the space capsule, all of those kind of things. How do you record data? How do you transmit data back to Earth? All of these things. And China just goes in and buys it off the shelf from Russia. So China, in a fell swoop, all of a sudden became a significant player in the space race. And now they're going ahead. When the United States fumbled and diddledy-doodled around, China was forging ahead, building space cities where all of their engineers went to work. The United States basically blew the lead, which they did. They had a technological lead over Russia and certainly over China, and now that's gone. It's all history. You have even India setting up projects for outer space, etc. Doing solar research with solar orbiting satellites. I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so anyway, China is now at the point where they can launch multiple satellites in a single launch. Okay, on to Japan. just want to mention here, and this is not related to space activity, but on New Year's Day, Japan had a significant earthquake. It was in the 7-point Richter scale range and did a lot of damage, and there were a lot of real severe aftershocks. And so that's a lot of times where the strenuousness, the stress that comes from being in an earthquake. I've been in earthquakes of that magnitude, 7 earthquake. I was in Ecuador, and I was actually in the shower in the middle of the night. I was, I don't know, it was probably 9, 10 o'clock at night, something like that, and just in the shower, and all of a sudden, I'm being thrown back and forth from the sides of this shower, and it was slippery, with soap, and I mean, showers with a tile floor. And so and the lights go out, so it's perfectly dark. I mean, I can't see a thing. And so I managed to get out of the shower, so I'm soaking wet and full of soap, and I remembered where I had put my towels. So I grabbed that and I run out of the bathroom area, and there are these like bumping into tables and furniture and trying to get to the door, and at least I could see a little bit of light to where the door was to get out of the building. It was on the first floor. And so I make my way out into the street, and by this time the streets are full of people and they're all screaming bloody murder. I mean, it was just like you have never heard screaming like this. And people trying to get their kids out of buildings, cracks in the building, I looked down and I could see the coast. I could see the coastline maybe probably 5 miles away from where I was at on this street. And it was lightening up like a light bulb, like a fluorescent light bulb turning on and off with the electricity associated with the earthquake. And that was, whew, I'll tell you, that's enough to rock your boat. It is. I mean, it's just because when the earth starts shaking under your feet at that level, like a 7.0 earthquake, it's really amazing. And so anyway, that it stopped. And I thought, well, typically the next aftershock will be about 15 minutes away. So I'm going to quick go back in and rinse off and hopefully get some clothes on because I'm standing there with, by this time I had the towel wrapped around me. And I guarantee you nobody really cared if I was running out in the street naked, full of soap. Nobody, I guarantee you, noticed because it was the middle of the night. There were probably people already sleeping. So I go back into the shower thinking I probably got another 15 minutes to go, and I'm in the middle of rinsing off, and wham, the next aftershock hits like within a couple minutes. And so I go through the same routine, go out of the building. This time I had my clothes at least identified, and I took those with me out into the street, and so I'm putting my clothes on, still soaking wet. Oh my goodness. No, that's an earthquake just shatters your world. And then the aftershocks, because you don't know, and everybody's out in the street. The buildings have big cracks in them, and you don't dare go back in that building because that building could come down on top of you. So everybody's out in the street. And then when the aftershocks hit, which they're going to be aftershocks, then everybody's like, oh, no, not again. No, and this keeps going on for days, and the aftershocks keep going on for weeks. It is not a fun experience. And so anyway, the poor Japanese people there. But what they say is they had some food, some ability to get food, but water was the first thing in demand. The first thing they ran out of any supply of water, because the pipes break, the water distribution links break. And so water is the one thing that people just don't have. In a lot of cases, they have water, but not clean water that you need to drink, to bathe the kids, because all facilities are shut down. The bathrooms don't work anymore. Wow. So anyway, by the way, there was another 4.1 in Los Angeles around the same time. Okay, so I digress a little bit there, but the point I wanted to make is that you have to have your own source of water. In case of emergency, I don't care what emergency it is, you need your own source of fresh water. Okay. Let's see here. This is some ongoing space news of what to expect in the upcoming years. A company called United Launch Alliance, AL, I'm sorry, ULA, United Launch Alliance, launched to the moon a lander. This is aboard a Falcon Centaur, and the first presence of the United States to be on the moon. NASA has, I think, five payload packages, experimental packages. And by the way, this is an unmanned launch. It's an unmanned mission, but it'll be the first time the United States has been to the moon in, or allegedly been to the moon in 50 years or more. Literally, the 1970s would have been the last recorded alleged Apollo moon landing. So it's been that long since the United States has had a presence, a lander presence on the moon. Okay, so anyway, that's going on, and there's going to be more of these. Elon Musk has a program to go to the moon. There's various NASA programs of varying degrees to get to the moon. So we'll see how that comes out. Typically, these landers don't make it, and there might be a very good reason for why, either if it's on Mars or on the moon. A lot of the private ones just don't make it. There was one about a year ago. It was actually in an XPRIZE candidate, and they almost made it to touchdown when a bunch of systems failed, which were unrelated. A very bizarre situation, to my way of reckoning. And NASA was the telecommunications link between that spacecraft and ground. And so something happened where it just didn't make it to the landing. The retro rocket cut out, and various things all happened at the same time, all seemingly unrelated systems. So it just told me that there was something funny amiss about the failure of that spacecraft. Let's see, Astrobotics, the Peregrine, there also NASA has payloads on that. NASA has some contractual activity going on for low Earth orbits. That is the within the 200 miles of the surface of the Earth, low Earth orbit, and they're partnering with Blue Origins. That's the Jeff Bezos company that I believe is officed in Huntsville, Alabama. They have a lot of, at least a lot of engineering staff there. And so there's activity there where they're ramping up the interest in low Earth orbit. And this is related to habitats, to, in other words, places where people would actually go and spend some time, whether astronauts or eventually possibly the paying public. NASA is supporting some innovative, they have an innovative research program. And I actually had some funding in that once upon a time innovative research program, and it was minimal, but they have this program where they present for the private individuals or companies present research programs, and then NASA goes through their meat grinder to approve some of them, and one of them is to study the planet Venus. Oh, now the one thing that I have to say is that whenever you work with NASA, you have to kowtow to their theoretical structure that the solar system began 4.5 billion years ago, that Venus is a planet, always been a planet, never been a comet. So what are they going to learn? Probably not much. I've always said that if, say, you put more money into the space program, they're always clamoring for more money, you would simply get more of the same. You're not going to get something new or innovative or better or somehow improved or better homogenized and blended. No, you're simply going to get more of the same. You're going to spend more money and get the exact same thing you had before. Here's a company, Diversified Technology Inc., and I want to look into this a little bit more, but they have a new innovative space propulsion engine that they are working on, and I believe this is under a NASA contract also. But the idea is that there are better ways to move your spacecraft in outer space. It's a field that I actually worked on quite a bit and still have some activity going on in that area as far as space launches, space propulsion systems, etc. Okay, now India has a solar probe, and this is very interesting for a country like India that really doesn't have much of a space program, does not have a manned space presence in terms of its own programs, yet it has seen fit to fund a program to study the sun at close range. So their solar orbiter is now in orbit around the sun, and that's going to be interesting to watch to see all of the information that might come out of that. Because India is an independent company, excuse me, a country, and they don't necessarily have to settle for the NASA line that the sun's fusion is going on in the core, all of that baloney that NASA tries to pawn off. So we'll see what India comes up with. The jury is still out on that one. And then last but not least here on my list is that the Hubble telescope is looking at exoplanets, as is the James Webb Telescope and other facilities. So they have observed that some of the exoplanets, now these are planets in other star systems. So they're a star that has a planetary system, and they're now able to see these blocking out the light from the star, the local star, and looking at the conditions of the atmosphere, and they've been able to see these exoplanet atmospheres change with time. So the interesting observations, so they can determine a lot more about these planets, what they're like, how they're similar or different to the planets in our own system, etc. Okay, so those are a few of the things you'll be seeing up in this upcoming year of 2024. Just want to remind you that I have a sale on the whole house water filters, the MR5. The MR5 comes with its original pack of filter elements, a UV sterilizer. It's the biggest, most powerful one in the industry, 36 inches long, with two UV bulbs. Now, you change those out every 12 months, so that gives you 2 years worth of use. Then the extra set of filter elements for the MR5. It is called the best deal, and it's on sale for $800 off, a super deal. Price now is $1,580, and that big deduction should more than cover your plumbing installation. And so go to the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, and also, like I said, look for that link to the premium coffee page. If you're a coffee drinker, you have to check that out. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.